Talk given Friday, 9th April 1976. I would like this evening first to summarize the topics we dealt with at our previous Friday meeting. You remember, we dealt with this problem of the accusation leveled against the person who was seriously concerned with living the religious life, that in so many cases he is only selfishly concerned with his personal salvation, that the living the religious life is a retreat from everyday life. And we saw that the answer to that, very simply, is just this, that no human being exists or can possibly exist utterly separated from the world in any way whatsoever. If there were no world, if there were no people, no objects, no sun, light, air, earth, and so on, the individual would just be non-existent. Each one of us is completely interdependent with and interacting with the environment, which means that if one takes it to the ultimate limit, with the totality, the whole universe, and every single person in it, every single object in it, lives and functions and manifests itself by virtue of this interrelationship, perpetual interrelationship. So, the argument that the person retreats from life and has nothing to do with the world just doesn't hold good at all. Now, we were concerned at our previous weekend with these great problems in our modern world, the problems of violence, of fear, of the loss of moral principles and so forth, the laxness of human beings and all the rest of it. And we tried to see something of the root sources of all this. In the individual himself, we know that all the usual failings are there, the aggressiveness, the egoism, the vanity, and so on and so on. And it is these elements in each single individual which, as long as they are there, will spoil his influence upon his environment. Because that which affects the environment is myself as a whole human being. What am I actually, totally? And it is what I am which affects my environment, in fact. And that is the practical problem to tackle, as far as the individual is concerned. And then we looked into one small aspect, small in the sense of size, but of profound consequence in human life. One aspect of the general situation. Where does the trouble start? Who has failed? Why am I aggressive, egoistic, and all the rest of it? Well, my conditioning plays a very important part in making me like that. And what conditions me? Generally speaking, my environment. But where does my environment begin? In the home. From the time I'm born onwards. And therefore, if I grew up ignorant, ill-mannered, disobedient, inconsiderate, and so forth, one may point one's finger at the parents to start with. Now the question arises, how is one to tackle this? We have to be, and we touched upon the point that since the real influence of each one of us depends upon what we ourselves actually are, not only what we say or how we behave outwardly, whilst inside ourselves we may be seething with anger or whatever it is, you see. Since it depends upon what we actually are, then it is incumbent on us to realize our humanness in the deep, true sense of the word human, to the full, which means nothing less than living the religious life. See, the inner life, the state of the psyche, the state of the mind, it is from within our minds and hearts that our desires and our plans for action and everything arise. If that source is clean and pure, then we have the best chance to see a new trend come into our present world condition. Because there's no doubt that the world's moral backbone is certainly suffering from awful disease to start with. And you find this lack of morality in every aspect of our life. So it rests with each one of us to live that religious life in order that the practical affairs of the world could change. People always talk in terms of the haves and the have-nots and all sorts of things like that. But as long as I am greedy and egoistic, as long as I have a power lust, I myself will do everything I can in order to increase the distance between the man with whom I am competing and myself. Inevitable. And if he hasn't got the ability that I have to win out against him in all the affairs of life, be they business or the professional spheres or the cultural spheres or whatever they are, if he hasn't got a similar ability, well, I shall win out against him. So there's everlastingly the difference. I will have, he will have not. It's no good trying to legislate for equality and all the rest of it. It's utterly futile. If such things could have brought about a reasonably human state of affairs, it could have been done thousands of years ago. But it never has been done. Why? Because I myself am always destroying any intellectualistically imposed idealism upon the world. Now, I think it might be helpful if we discussed together today some of these practical problems which face us, with the children in the home to start with, and of course the young, and from there we move on to the older ones and so forth. After all, children look to their parents for guidance. Do modern children have a real trust and respect, a sense of inner security in relation to their parents? What do you all think? You have all experienced life, you've seen life. What do you feel?
There's a difference, of course, between general and the particular. In general, I think the children don't trust their parents, and this is I'm generalizing very widely, you know. The only discipline they understand is if somebody gives them a thump, they've gone beyond all bounds of reason. And a lot of them, particularly in my area, feel they're not wanted by their parents at certain hours and just go out and smash things up. And this is unfortunately very widespread over the country. This feeling of being bored and having no one to turn to. This lack of respect for their parents, because their parents haven't required that respect.
Because their parents have never respected them, in fact.
Yes. Now, doesn't that imply that the parents perhaps have failed to give them attention, the right sort of attention? Now, in the last century, at least in some parts of the world, we had this attitude that children are to be seen and not heard. Well, if the child feels that the parent will not listen to him, the child also, perhaps unconsciously, stops listening to the parent.
My doctor gave me some very good advice, I think, when my baby was very young. He said that spoiling a child is giving a child everything except what he needs.
That's very well put. Spoiling a child means giving a child everything except what he really needs.
We have quite a few teachers at the Buddhist Society who are members, and one of them said, she used the words, parents buy them off with a lot of pocket money because they don't want to give them attention. They give them a lot of money, about £3 or £4 a week, as much as that. But they don't spend any time with them. So that's the same thing.
Isn't this the hardest thing? And the hardest thing is to give of yourself to anybody, children or anybody. You can give money to charity, you can give all sorts, but to give of yourself is the hardest thing.
It is true. Giving of yourself is the hardest thing. Well, you've touched upon a very important point. Because here is the great problem of love, and the great meaning of love. Love is this real giving of oneself, unreservedly, without looking for any return. Love is not a business. This is the point. A buying and selling of goods or anything like that. And it is a giving unconditionally. This is what the whole world has never really seen for literally thousands of centuries. Thousands of centuries. It hasn't seen that. This complete and total giving. This is where the teaching of the great teachers comes in so wonderfully. Look at the way the Buddha presented the whole concept and the whole practice, the fulfilling of loving kindness, or if you like to use a less strong word, friendship, of compassion. Hey, most extraordinary. Whatsoever another does unto one, one's own mind will not succumb to enmity, but will suffuse that other person with loving kindness. And starting with that person, extend it to the whole world, so that that love has grown far-reaching, immeasurable, under any and every circumstance. A remarkable saying in that discourse, the parable of the saw. Even if a saw, you know, the thing to cut with, even if low-down thieves were to carve you limb from limb, even then, if he's talking to his monks, even then, if you allow yourself minds to feel enmity, you are not doers of my teaching. What did Jesus say? The same sort of thing. What did the Upanishads say? In thought and feeling, in word and in action, in every way, complete harmlessness, complete charity, complete kindliness, ruth is the actual word which is used, our English word ruth. It has a wonderful meaning, that word. They all taught the same sort of thing. This transcendental love, which means that for the individual there must be a transcendental ethic to live by, if one is to be fully human. In terms of society and the interaction with society, there is reciprocity always. Social interrelation, any interrelations involve reciprocity. And one can't see a transcendental expression of ethic in a situation of reciprocity unless the two or more who are concerned in the situation are all individually capable of a transcendental ethic. See, that of course is something a little bit too heavenly for our world at this stage. But this question of love comes up. We do not know what love is, and we do not know how to love, really. When we do know how to love, we will never know that we are loving. Whatever we know in our ordinary sense of the word know implies that we can measure it. Because we know this specifically, limitedly, by virtue of comparing it with something else. But as long as there is the consciousness of a something else, an otherness, then there is the conflict of duality present. So you never know when you really love.
Talking about bringing up children, though, we might revert to that. Also, the question of discipline was mentioned by Brett. This is a subject which is a very fixed one, vexed one, the question of discipline in the upbringing of children. Could you say anything about that?
Well, of course, it is a tremendous problem, the discipline of children. First of all, one has to come to know the child. Every single child is unique. In the same family, for instance, you might find one child who is completely cooperative, and you might find another child who is not exactly cooperative, is troublesome and this, that and the other. And it is something inherent in the child too, apart from any environmental influences which may have brought about that uncooperativeness. If adrenals and thyroid and so forth overfunction, then that person's going to be really rambunctious and very self-assertive and all the rest of it. You have to take that into account. And so the question of discipline varies from person to person. Someone needs a sort of a strong controlling hand, a firm controlling hand. Another person just needs a gentle request. And you see, each person likes to see a certain quality come from the other. One likes to see one's mother behave like this and one's father behave like this and so forth. And my brother or my sister would like to see something different from what I would like to see. Because the liking is according to one's fundamental nature. The blueprint at the time of conception with all the chromosomes and, you know, the good old story which we all know nowadays, hormones and genes and so forth. That is a blueprint for the individual. And you can never defy that blueprint too far. If you try to, you'll be an awful mess. You see? So, the question of discipline with children is always a very difficult one indeed. But what do you feel about certain outstanding things? Good manners, to start with. I don't mean just the external observances of this type, that if you suddenly sneeze, you say, "Oh, excuse me." That's an external expression only. That's very external. But good manners fundamentally implying considerateness for others. And with the element of the aesthetic playing its part. The real aesthetic element, not just a put-on thing,
one of the elements of chivalry, wasn't it, in the medieval period?
Exactly. Now, in those centuries when chivalry flourished as such, it flourished because there was a certain conception of the right relationship between people. And so there was this element of chivalry. It was, of course, a very restricted sphere. It applied only to knights and damsels.
I think manners must be taken as showing consideration for the other person. I think they must be taken as showing consideration for the other person.
Oh, yes.
Particularly when trying to get them into the head of a young person. If one were to talk to them, for instance, of such a thing as a chivalry, they would immediately think of formal manners and rebel against them. They don't seem, until they're old enough to understand it, they don't like formalism.
Great. What do you feel about this matter, that in the upbringing of children, one should help them to understand that any sort of wrongdoing inevitably brings painful consequence to oneself as well as to others? Any right doing brings about consequences which are not painful consequences. It's one of the troubles with the modern world, and this applies not only to children, but to all the grown-ups, who just live by might is right. We have the power to demand this, that, and the other from the management or the state or our neighbors, and we are going to get it because we have the strength to extract it if needs be. So if children are brought up to understand from the beginning the difference between right doing and wrong doing. And we all know in a very simple manner precisely what right doing and wrong doing in a social milieu means. The simple moralities of which ask human beings to be considerate, to be harmless, to be truthful, honest, friendly, and all that sort of thing.
Yes, I see that imposing punishments can easily bring about a state where a child thinks that it's all right to do wrong as long as you don't get discovered.